After these messages, we'll be right back.
Was ist das?
Ist der Poppenlocken Korkenblocken?
That's right, Kinder. It's der Poppenlocken Korkenblocken. It is imperative that he not enter the hen house and impregnate your chickens, or your egg harvest will be unsatisfactory.
Och, a hen house? I must service my base needs within, ja?
Mach schnell!
Poppenlocken Korkenblocken, you must halt his sinful impulse.
Nein!
Poppenlocken Korkenblocken, shoot him with these plastic eggs.
Nein!
The Poppenlocken Korkenblocken is a fun party game for children ages 7 to 13. After 13, you are expected to contribute to society. Some assembly required. On sale now at Kinderschrecklich Spielzeugladen. Offer not valid in Spreckenhaltestell.
Welcome to Afterthought, the companion podcast to System Mastery, where every other week John and I get together and talk about whatever the hell is of interest to us, and then also we answer questions from you that are of no interest to us.
Ha ha! We hate you. All of our listeners are terrible.
Hi, John. How are you this week?
I'm so good.
It's been a good weekend, hasn't it? I mean, granted, we did tell the listeners that we'd be playing Exalted this weekend.
And we lied.
We did not. We did not play Exalted this weekend. We had to push it back due to
technical difficulties.
A technical difficulty. We'll actually finally, for reals, get to play a role-playing game between the two of us at the same time with some other people in about 2 weeks.
Yeah. Until that point, though, it's my birthday.
Oh, that's right. I guess it's John's birthday weekend, sort of. His birthday's like a Tuesday or something.
Well, yeah, when this comes out, it's going to be my birthday.
Oh, that's right. I guess it will be.
Yeah.
Well, then happy birthday, future John.
Yeah, future John is like, what's up now? I'm at work.
I'm old.
I'm 1 year closer to death, finally.
Well, future John's probably going to enjoy the measly, crappy present I have for him in the closet right now.
Oh, yeah, finally.
But you'll have to wait till we actually do something for your birthday.
Yeah, which will be next weekend.
I was going to say, going out to breakfast with your girlfriend but not me doesn't count. You don't get a present for that. You need to invite me to a place where I can buy a drink.
Yeah, that's what it is. That's how a birthday works.
Yep. So what did we review last week?
So we read Blue Planet.
Yeah, Blue Planet. That's right.
And boy howdy, did people have some things to say about that.
There were a couple of strong opinions, a few people who actually have played the game and said that it is an enjoyable experience. And you know what? I actually, upon creating a character, developed a little bit of an appreciation for the character creation system.
Well, like I had said during the actual review, I feel like the system isn't bad. It's fairly decent. It holds together all right.
There are some interesting ideas in there. The whole wounds thing where, you know, it's not a cumulative, abstracted system, and each wound is its own issue. You have to deal with it at a later time. That was fairly well done, because I've seen that a million times, where people are like, well, hit points are bullshit. Here's how it should really work. And, well, the end result is some convoluted system that's a death spiral.
Yeah, it's essentially the old White Wolf, we're still using hit points, but now it sucks more.
Yes. So that, you know, there were certain things to be spoken for it that were quality that I maybe didn't get to, just because the book's tone was a little tough to survive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's one of the, like, well, really the big question that I'm going to have before we get to our listener questions that I have for you is, what level of the story should you be giving to your players before you get into it? Because we've seen in a lot of the games that we've reviewed, some of them have, like, this or, say, 7th Sea or a lot of other ones have a weird background meta plot, things that are happening in the world that would be interesting hooks for players, but it feels like the writers want to, like, Twilight Zone, M. Night Shyamalan, surprise the players, the twist to the world. But the problem is, especially with Blue Planet, so much of that twist is what the hook for playing it feels like it should be.
Yeah, I think you actually have to kind of gauge what you're doing. The more specific your game story is, I feel like the softer hand you need to apply when writing the core book, because you're going to run into people who aren't interested in that meta plot. Like, for example, I've already mentioned it a few times, but I've been reading Feng Shui 2 for the past couple of weeks, and I am in love with it. It is an awesome game, but it's got a very strong sense of story. Mm-hmm. It's set in, like, a weird time travel. It's like, honestly, the story's the hardest part for me to care about, because all I love is the absolutely amazing rules. I've come around to it a lot since I started reading it, but it's got this sort of 1850s wuxia high action kung fu wire fu cinema feel, but it also has like a future where cyber apes are battling it out, and you can jump from time to time within it. And if people aren't into that, then they're going to miss out on, you know, one of the coolest rule systems I've seen in a game in a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to kind of run this gamut where you're like, all right, I have an interesting rule system I want to present to people, but I also want to hook them into my story.
Well, I think it depends on also how much you are dependent on that, because the rules for Feng Shui 2, you can basically just play in one time. Like if you just wanted to play in, you know, 69 AD or whatever, you could just have your entire campaign set there, cut out the time traveling aspect entirely, and you're fine.
Yeah. And I mean, you don't even need to do that. The rule system is solid enough that you can easily use it to write up other characters very quickly. I've been sitting around at lunch the past couple of weeks writing up Blimp Legger archetypes in it. I have like Blimp Captain and Rigger Guy, the person who climbs around out on the ropes, and Union Sorcerer, and all these other things I've just been sort of tinkering with because it's so easy to do, because you don't really have to write a lot of moving parts. They come right out the box with everything they're supposed to have already.
Yeah, but for something like Blue Planet, I feel like when the thing you're trying to sell people on for your setting is this is a rad alien world, and I know a lot of people have pointed out, oh, well, it's hard sci-fi, which means they're trying to, you know, worry about things like how you get to places in space and what you need to do to survive in places.
How money works, yeah.
Yeah, but the problem with that is I'm fine with hard sci-fi. You can do that, but give me a reason to care.
Yeah, like, that is...
Star Trek is hard sci-fi, but you can... Star Trek really is.
All right, well then how come they don't just make clones of people to go down to the planets instead of deleting them when they send them down there? Transporters ruin the whole hard sci-fi element of Star Trek. Hence, if it didn't have them, I would be on board with you. Actually, they'd also need to not have warp and holodecks. But otherwise, I'm on board with you.
For a second, and I thought you said they would need to not have warp.
They can't have warp. They also can't have data. I'm not cool with that. That's not going to work.
Also, space. I don't like that.
I don't like that they're going into space. That's bothering me.
Aliens need that.
Post-commerce society where everyone just gets paid according to their needs, I guess.
I mean, basically all I'm saying is if this was Shadowrun, I'd be on board.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If Star Trek was a Larry Niven novel, it'd be fine, but it's not. It's off sci-fi. But anyway, moving on.
Well, it is the difference between a Star Trek and a Star Wars. Star Wars is very much, we don't give a fuck how anything works.
Mm-hmm.
We just go, it's a lightsaber. How does a lightsaber work? Magic. Fuck you. It doesn't matter.
Fair enough. I mean, but Star Trek does the same thing. It's just that their fuck you comes in the form of technobabble.
Yeah.
They're just like, how does a transport porter work? You confabulate the ion train until all of a sudden you've created a negative mass of super protons.
Well, it's the difference between, say, going with Star Trek's warp, which is actually we are warping space in order to move fast. And you're like, okay, at least you've given me an explanation. And Star Wars's like hyperdrive, what happens? Oh, light.
We went real fast.
We went real, real fast.
Don't worry about it. We just got somewhere. Although even Star Trek's warping space thing doesn't work because they end up going to places and getting there in a month instead of getting there and everyone else has aged 70 years. So it's the bare edge of hard sci-fi is what Star Trek is.
Yeah. Well, it's the most accessible of the hard sci-fi, I would say.
Fair enough. I would say some of those, like... I would almost say that Alien is probably the most accessible hard sci-fi. Like the first one, just Alien. Like in the future, there's grimy, shitty spaceships where working people have to hang around on them and drink and pretend to hit each other with knives, and then a gross animal attacks them.
I mean, that basically just sounds like my work environment.
Except it's a raccoon or a greasy customer. And his name is Chunkles.
Aw, damn you, greasy Chunkles, get out of here.
What the hell are we talking about?
I'm talking about setting in a game and how much they need to tell you. So the hooks in a game for, like, Blue Planet, they should really have gone a little farther and maybe explained to the player. Like, I know that they have it in the moderator's guide and other supplements, like, oh, here's what's actually going on. But for the player, you look at a book and you kind of go, okay, why do I want to be in this game? even with, say, the Feng Shui 2 weird time travel thing, the immediate hook of that game is because I want to play an action hero.
Yeah.
And you get that immediately and it hooks you. With Blue Planet, you might go, oh, I want to do cool alien world stuff, but then it gives you nothing cool to do.
Yeah. Instead, it describes a bunch of stuff that won't happen to your character or has already happened.
Well, yeah, it's like, oh, what can you do? You can mine underwater. I'm like, I could do that on Earth. Why is this cool?
Yeah. And the weird thing is that the more it tells its story, the softer the sci-fi gets. Because when you start reading about the supplementary materials and what have you, it's all like, aliens seeded this planet with super DNA. And there's crazy exobiology underwater that you can get that'll extend your lifespan. And you're like, wait a minute, this is turning into just White Wolf down here. Like, the closer, the more it reveals the story, the less hard sci-fi it is.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that's true of everything. I think the problem with Star Trek, by the way, is that you can't keep hard sci-fi for, like, 400 episodes.
No. You can't, because you can go ahead and say, oh, I've got this book, and I'm just going to talk about how cool it would be if we actually did this one hard sci-fi thing.
Yeah.
But if you then go, now I have four different series worth of shit, you're like, nope.
Yeah. At that point, you're going to run into that episode where Dr. Crusher encounters a Scottish rape ghost.
Yeah.
I mean, that's weird hard sci-fi. I mean, it's a little bit of a hard sci-fi.
I mean, eventually you're going to have to shoot God with a photon torpedo.
You're going to shoot God, have an argument with him. You're going to have to realize that everyone just talks about 20th century stuff as if the past 300 years didn't happen.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, but yeah, at the very beginning, like, if you're watching Star Trek 1, like, the first episode, it's like, yeah, it's kind of hard sci-fi, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe. It just falls apart under serialization.
Well, yeah, because they keep having to explain more and more things.
And they keep needing to come up with more and more contrived explanations so they can tell stories. Like, you know, everyone needs an evil twin because that's cheap to film.
Oh, yeah. Like, I had this cool idea for something we could do. All right.
We've got this hotel set and these 1940s tuxedos.
Oh, don't you ever besmirch that episode. That is fucking amazing.
I know it's a fucking amazing episode. It's just a soft sci-fi episode. That's not a bad word. I love soft sci-fi.
God, it's so good. Oh, Data.
I know. That is a really good episode, and it's a real shame when DS9 drops that particular baton.
Oh.
When you're like, all right, these guys did an amazing job at a period piece spy drama sort of thing. What do you got, DS9, a show that I normally consider superior? We've got a sort of Frank Sinatra-esque lounge singer, and you're just going to hate him. His name's Vic Fontaine, and you're just going to hate him.
Oh.
Oh. Oh, well.
Damn.
All right, you want to answer some questions from listeners?
We may as well. I mean, they did go to the trouble of writing them.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, here we go. Let's get a couple of questions in. I'll start this time. Hey there. I've been a fan of your guys' dumb podcast for about a year now, ever since you posted on the SA forums advertising it. I really enjoy listening to your show whenever I can, even if I cannot distinguish your guys' voices at all. Look, as John, I'm offended by that.
Obviously, you would be, John.
I do have a question that I thought of when I was recently GMing a Shadowrun game, and I was wondering on your guys' input on it. Say a player of yours rolls to use a skill or do a thing and comes up short. How do you represent that in-game? Do you usually say, oh no, you fail, you weren't good enough? Or do you make it so that some outside force or influence affected the character's outcome and ability to execute the action? The example I thought of was when a player of mine rolled to sneak through an apartment block and failed on his roll. Instead of having him trip and fall or something else, I said that a young child with his mother came out, saw the character, and screamed loud enough to alert everyone else in the building. When I realized that this is something I always do while GMing, and I wasn't sure if it was necessarily the correct thing to do when a character fails. What do you guys do, and what's your input on it? Many thanks, a voice blind listener.
Well, for me, I think that's a very good way to go, because it stops the... There's that whole thing with characters where you've made someone who's very competent at something, and when they fail at it, it makes no sense. So when you've got a guy who's like, I'm the best lock picker in the world, then he goes to pick, like, a regular lock and just happens to fail, and you can't just have him go, oh, jeez, guys, I don't know how to do this.
Yeah. I feel like if you're making characters roll to pick locks, it should not be to see whether or not they can. It's to see how long it should take.
And the pick lock is always the obvious one, but the stealth one also always comes up because there's always someone who's good at it and someone else who's following along behind that isn't.
And there's always a problem with stealth and a couple of the other, like, physically activities, like acrobatics and stuff. Like, when your character wants to pull off a rad, oh, let's just say that thing where you want to steal a diamond from a glass case and there's lasers around it.
Yeah, you want to go do that bendy acrobat thing through the lasers.
Yeah, exactly. Your impulse as a DM is always like, oh, yeah, you're going to have to roll, like, five acrobatics checks. And the answer should be, you have to roll one if you have to roll any. And all you do for the one is determine whether or not you set off a soft alarm or whether or not you almost hit a laser. Because ultimately, the question for these fail things is, does it progress the story forward if a person just blankly fails?
Yeah. And I mean, you can always also have like a follow-up to the fail to see if they can undo it.
Yes.
So let's say we're doing the laser grid thing again.
Yeah.
So they're in a weird contorted position, and then like a bead of sweat would be dropping onto a laser. You can give them one more acrobatics roll to see if they can then catch the bead of sweat before it hits a laser.
Yeah.
Let them be amazing at what they're amazing
at. Let them do a cool thing instead of being like, all right, roll. This is the thing that used to get me a lot back when I played D&D as a little kid, was the I want to stealth into that castle and just see what's going on. All right, you need to roll a stealth check for every 20 feet you move. Every time anyone might see you, they get to roll a spot check against your stealth check. And I'm like, this is just a numbers game. Eventually someone is going to spot me. This isn't worth it or fun.
No.
It should be a one-time thing where basically I go, I'd like to move in there and stealth around and look and see if they see anything. The DM should arbitrate whether or not that's a good idea for the story.
Well, yeah, if he goes, oh, I actually have a cool thing that would happen if someone saw you, let's see if that happens or not, great.
Yeah.
But if it's, I'm a super awesome stealth assassin guy, this castle is filled with chodlingers and no one cares,
yeah,
then let me walk around, see some stuff, and leave.
Right. And then just use it as an opportunity for further storytelling or to push the story forward. And if someone fails, still use it to push the story forward. Instead of being like, all right, one person saw you. Everyone in the castle is alerted to your presence. They all come outside, roll for initiative, and now you do not get surprise checks. It should be something more like you encounter one person.
And again, it's that whole let them undo the mistake by being rad.
Yeah, give them a chance to be rad. Give them a chance to progress the story in an interesting way. So I think you're doing the right thing. You're basically doing what I think is called fail forward.
Yeah, well, that's less fail forward and more just fail without making it the character's fault.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Fail due to environment. Assume your character. This is something I've always said, is assume baseline competency in your characters.
Yeah.
You're playing normally, I mean, there are games where you're not, but in most games, you're playing larger-than-life heroes. Let them do larger-than-life hero things.
Yep.
Okay.
All right, so let's see. We got another question here. If Gary Gygax were a monster in an RPG, what system would he appear in, and what would his stats be?
He'd be in D&D, because that's his game.
I was going to say he would be in a heartbreaker to D&D.
Yeah.
Because it would be someone who was slobbing the knob of Gary Gygax rather than actual D&D.
That's true. They'd probably put him in as a game designer right next to that game design skill.
Oh, yeah. And then he would be completely unbeatable and have godlike stats, because the only reason you're putting Gary Gygax in your game is because you love old D&D.
All right, well, here's going to be my answer, so it's a little more flippant than the straight-up making fun of Heartbreakers. He's going to be the Arum Gygax, or the Bearded Gorger, and he'll be a six-armed, golden-bearded monster with a die in each hand who burrows rapidly underground and attacks by flinging dice and crazy words at you.
Okay, but how is he different in this game than he was in real life, though?
See, his six arms.
Gary obviously only had four.
Yes, that's correct. I'm giving him an extra set of arms to turn him into a monster.
Ooh.
Also, he has a paralysis touch attack.
Which everyone knows normally it was a death touch attack.
That's correct.
We don't want to be as mean.
I'm softening him a little bit. What can I say?
You big softy.
I'm a Gary fan.
If John and Jeff, spelled wrong on both counts, were a two-headed monster in an RPG.
Hey, that, I agree with you there, Jeff. That's not how you spell our names.
So if they were a two-headed monster in an RPG, what would it be called, and what would the optimum method of killing it be?
Ooh, let's see. I like to figure that instead of being like an Etten sort of thing, that we'd actually be more along the lines of your cat dog.
Just half and half?
Yeah, just two front halves awkwardly. So we'd be kind of a push Jeff, pull John.
Yeah.
I think as what we'd end up being, just so we could argue with each other consistently.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I feel like the optimal way to kill us would simply be to put us in a place where we could make bad life decisions.
The optimal way to kill us is to just ask us how we poop, and then our heads explode.
That's right, and poop comes out.
Yeah.
That's the answer.
That's how.
You had to ask, didn't you? I feel like you wouldn't even need to do that. I mean, ultimately, we're pretty much killing ourselves as it stands. Just put us in a room with a lot of TV and pizza.
Mm.
We'll take care of the rest.
It'll happen.
You, me, and diabetes, buddy.
Has anyone designed an actual murder hobo RPG where you play as hobos wandering the street of major cities and murdering people?
Yes. Isn't that what you call it? What's the really cool one with the wizard type? The crazy street wizards. Unknown Armies.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, unknown armies. You're not necessarily walk. It's not like Rutger Hauer hobo with a shotgun situation. But
it could be.
You could play it that way. Unknown armies, if you haven't read it or heard of it, is a game where you play as basically street wizards. They're people who see paradox in the world and can draw power from that paradox, but they are so dedicated to it that a lot of the time they lose touch with what, you know, the rest of us associate from and desire from society and life. So they end up being hobos a lot of the time. Hobos, homeless people, drifters, porn actors, anything they can be that's basically fringe element society where they're only living to meet this one need, which is to gain power through some obscure type of magic.
Oh, yeah. I mean, even the people who aren't wizards, the whole point of it is you've managed to find out that there is magic, but magic is super weird.
And it's super hard to get, and it requires an insane amount of esoteric sacrifice. It's not enough to just kill animals. It's stuff like, in order for me to cast spells, I have to drink out of extremely rare glasses.
Yeah.
Like, I forget what that one's called, the alcohol wizard. But they're like, I can't, if I drink a
Dipsomancer.
Drink.
Dipsomancer.
Dipsomancer, thank you. If I drink something out of Winston Churchill's old cup.
Will Rogers's cup.
Will Wheaton's cup. Damn it, there's no alcohol in this. This is just chocolate milk. I can't cast a spell with Will Wheaton drinks. Give me a real celebrity. Just kidding, Will. Hi, we love you.
Okay. I think your celebrity couple name should be Jafonda. I guess that's not a question, just throwing it out there.
We've already established that our celebrity couple name takes the first half of Jeff's name and the second half of John's name. And so our celebrity couple name is, of course, John.
Obviously.
Yeah, or Jeff. It's your choice.
Yeah, you can flip it around.
Yeah, but it's really easy. Just take the first half and then the second half, and you either come up with Jeff or John. It's
Yeah,
no problem. Okay. But I do like Jafonda. I think that's cute. I feel like that's one of the three singers in Little Shop of Horrors.
Good.
I wasn't loitering. Was you, Jafonda?
And finally, if Twitter had existed all through history, which historical figure would have been the most annoying person to follow? Who would have had the most followers? And what would have been the trendiest hashtags?
Oh, geez, I don't know. Let's see. Hashtag spontaneous generation. Oh, my meat magically grew fly or maggots. Hashtag spontaneous generation. Guys, check out my armpits. Hashtag boobo.
Oh, hashtag boobo. Free the boobo.
I don't know. Let's see what else we got in there.
Most followers, I'm going to go ahead and say Alexander the Great.
Oh, that dude would have had a lot of followers. That is true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Most annoying person to follow, I'm going to say...
It'd be one of them Roman emperors that isn't as bad as history made them out to be. Like, it'd be like a Nero or something like that. You know,
most annoying person to follow, Caligula.
Oh, how about that horse he made a senator?
Yeah, that... No, he would be the best person to follow. It would just be horse e-books,
oh,
but
dude,
in Roman
horse
times.
E-senators?
Yeah, horse e-senator. There you go, and that is... Thanks all for now. Good day, sirs. That was Gary Gygax's Gas Guy Gary.
Oh, he got you with his tongue twister.
He did.
Oh, that's too bad. All right, well, we'll move on to my next one here. Dear Jeff and John.
Spelled correctly.
Oh, yeah, that is spelled correctly. Thank you so much, Dr. Greg Glittergold, DDS. All right, hot dog question.
Here we go.
One hot dog question. Let me go ahead and sing the hot dog question theme song. Here we go. You ready?
Muppet Babies.
No, that's not right.
Hold on.
That's never been right.
That's never correct.
Anyway, you are looking for a roommate and you're in luck. A dapper talking hot dog has answered your wanted ad. He is a model roommate. He cleans up after himself. That is not true of the one hot dog I know.
Shut up.
Isn't too loud and pays rent on time. Do you eat your human-sized hot dog roommate? Choose wisely. P.S. There are no legal ramifications for eating him, but you will need a new roommate if you do.
Man, that is offensive. How dare you bring up the fact that it's still legal to eat me and my brethren?
Oh, I thought you were offended that I pointed out that you don't clean up after yourself.
Oh, no,
you
that's
dog.
Obvious. I am just a dirt golem at this point.
It doesn't really matter. I mean, seeing as how you're floating slightly above the ground, as a talking hot dog does, you can have a layer of socks and garbage just and old pizza boxes beneath you. You're never going to notice.
No, and I'm sort of like Pigpen at this point, that I've just got like a cloud of dirt following me around.
Yeah, and flies and seagulls.
Yeah.
Locusts.
And then when I'm by the bay, I'm followed by bagels.
Well, that's terrible. All right. So as always, I'm the one who asked the question. So, John, your follow-up. Would you eat your large talking hot dog roommate?
I mean, probably, yeah.
Probably?
I am a cannibal, so.
All hot dogs are cannibals. Little known fact.
But now you know.
Yeah. Anyway, there you go. John says yes. The answer to that question is a resounding yes. As you know, with all hot dog questions, we do not tell him whether he was right or wrong. We merely want to gauge his response.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. If you could have the exact events of the film Die Hard happen to you, would you take it? You take the place of John McClane and everything happens the same way, so you kill all the terrorists, walk on broken glass, and do tape a gun to your back near the end. You don't get to choose other paths. You are fated to have everything happen just like the movie, but you did feel every emotion and sensation John McClane did. This comes from Ted Cheddar.
Ooh.
The answer is no.
No, I don't.
I am a big whiny bitch.
And also, I don't feel like he got all that much out of his adventure.
When no, really... when you go to Die Hard 2, it's not like, oh yeah, John McClane, noted famous person and in like super rich guy.
No, he's just grumpy cop waiting to get on a plane at the start of 2. It's not till you get to 5 where he's like fucking Superman for some reason. But in the first one, he's already got like one of my least favorite motivations and rewards in any kind of movie, which is to get your ex-wife back.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's just the standard cop thing.
I hate that shit. You know, if your wife leaves you, you shouldn't spend your life trying to get her back. Don't worry about it. Move on. It's so creepy when they do that, especially when in movies, and they didn't do this in Die Hard, thank God, but that thing in movies where they have the new husband and the old husband has to prove himself better than the new one.
Yeah.
And then the new one invariably has some moment where it turns out they were a jerk and you didn't know.
You know, at least I'll give Liar Liar this. It never turned out that Cary Elwes was a bad guy.
No, and you know, the movie that did it the best recently, Ant-Man. Because, what's her name, had been remarried, and the new husband turns out to just be a good, interesting guy who's concerned about his stepdaughter.
Yep.
I was like, oh, that's great. He didn't have to prove himself to, why can't I remember her name from Arrested Development? I like her so much. Judy Greer.
Katie Couric.
Judy Greer. He doesn't prove himself to her or anything like that. He's just like, hey, you guys keep being married. I'm not going to try and muscle in like in fucking Superman Returns. So, no, I'd pass on that just because I really, you know, if my wife decides she wants to leave me, I'm not going to win her back by killing people. That just seems like instead, I'm going to let her die in a tower.
Also, man, how am I going to be able to, like, go on with the rest of my life after that? Because I'm not from then on John McClane. I don't get to continue being a super badass. I just experience all of the things in that movie, and then it's like, all right, well, back to work.
Well, could you experience all the things in that movie without having been John McClane in the first place? It's like, well, you're on a ride, isn't it? It's just like
you have the exact events of the film Die Hard happen to you.
Oh, but not the events preceding Die Hard, for example.
Exactly.
So your character is not a New York cop. Or is he a California cop visiting New York? Which way does that work? I think he's a New York cop visiting California.
Yeah, but you see, the way it works is it's happening to you.
Okay, do you even get a ride to... No, you do, because that's in the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So anything that's...
So you do have your limo driver.
Yeah, you have a limo driver. You do meet Reginald Bell Johnson towards the end.
yeah.
The only thing you don't get to do is be a cop in the first place. So you're just sort of on a ride.
Yeah, no, I mean... It's having the events happen to you, but you aren't John McClane, which means afterwards you're like, oh my God, I can't believe that happened to me.
I got my boring 80s-haired wife back. Wait, she's not my wife. I don't want this.
Although I have to say, I suppose I would then, if it wasn't just you get to like quantum leap into Die Hard and then you're done, mm-hmm. If it's you literally have the events of Die Hard happen to you, then... I mean, maybe, because I could probably turn that into, like, all the TV shows I would be on. I would be super famous at that point.
I just feel like...
Also, I would get to meet Alan Rickman.
Oh, good call. Although you're not allowed to say anything to him. You can't be like, dude...
No, I couldn't change it.
You could be
I
like,
would
dude,
be
you're
like...
the only good part of Prince of Thieves. And he'd be like, what is that? I don't remember if I did that movie before or after Die Hard.
Oh, it's definitely after.
I know, it's definitely after. He was pretty much unknown in Die Hard.
Yeah. But I, you know what? No, if I got to change my answer, I get to meet Alan Rickman, and I will go ahead and turn those events into me being awesome.
I just want to pick a different Alan Rickman movie then. Also, I still want to start him to star in Alan Rickman's Greatest Sandwich in America. This sandwich is acceptable. All right, I'm going to go with no, because I don't... Well, actually, I would say yes if I knew in advance that it was going to happen. If I was like, I agree to this, and in a month it's going to happen, then I could probably place some really interesting bets and be set for life after that.
Real interesting
bets.
Hey,
look, I bet you the exact events of Die Hard are going to happen to me. Bet you $3 million the exact events of Die Hard are going to happen to me. I mean, I'm going to write ho, 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 I have a machine gun or whatever it is on a sweater. I'm going to do all those things.
Done.
Take that bet. Whatever rich person I managed to get in a room with.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see. Hello, John and Jeff.
Spelled half correct.
Half correct. They got me, but not you. That's okay. I've always let this slide. This is why I didn't let you read the questions.
I just like it, because we've had all wrong, all right, and now half and half.
Yeah. The easy key to our names, folks, is that it's both three-letter words.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, I really don't care. You can spell my name however you want. I've gone through my whole life assuming the extra F is, with other people assuming the extra F is there.
Yeah, and I've had everyone assume that there's an H there.
Yeah, it's fine. We're both very used to it. Anyway, I was re-listening to some of my favorite episodes, and the AD&D First Edition episode sparked some memories for me. You know, that's actually one of my favorites, too. We go really off the rails in that one. If you haven't listened to the AD&D First Edition review, go back and check it out. We get to the point where we're showing that the characters in it believe that they are in a role-playing game by design.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a fun one. Anyway, sparked some memories for me. I found the show while trying to find an AD&D live play episode, but your show was the only thing that came up was your show. So that was the first episode I heard, and you used a lot of big words and grammar and said something about how you're smarter than most people, and this led me to believe that for the longest time that the point of the show was just two really smart people talking about RPGs. Since then, I've come to realize you are just idiots who know way too much about RPGs and 80s pop culture. Hey, I know a lot about 90s pop culture, too.
Come on now.
Thank you. Okay, like the rest of us. Anyway, your show is the best, and it's great. Thanks, Rory.
Great, no question.
Well, I don't know. We got to be smarter than a lot of people, Rory. If you think about it, half the people in the world are above average.
I mean, we got to be smarter than a lot of people. If you think about it, you're listening to us.
It's true.
So, here we go. Is Kevin Symbieto weird for writing his books with such an informal tone? Or was Gygax the weird one for writing so formally? What kind of tone should a game be written in so as to not annoy its potential audience? From Ryan M.
Oh, I forgot to put Ugh in front of Ryan.
Ugh. Ryan.
I should say Ryan. let's see. Let's talk about this real quick.
Well, again, that's going to depend on the game you're playing.
Does Kevin Symbieta actually have an informal tone? I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think he's got a braggy tone.
Yeah, but that's only when it's like his forewords and stuff like that. When you're reading the books that are like, here's an article or whatever, an entry for this alien or this group of people or whatever.
Yeah, his forewords tend to be, even then, not informal, just redolent of braggadocio.
Yeah.
So to speak. He's just, yeah, I had a great idea. And then I had
other people write it for me.
Someone else write it for me. And then it was still my idea and I took the credit.
I think the thing for me is the tone for the book definitely should go along with what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
I think Symbieta's tone in the writing is fairly close to what you'd want out of Rifts anyway, mm-hmm. just because it's a weird, like, 12-year-old explosions game where he's just taking all of his action figures and throwing them together.
Yeah.
And if you had a super formal, like, oh, yes, and then you need to have the coalition, and they'll be doing this. If your tone was way too stuffy, then that game would feel weird. Like, if they were trying to get you to take that game way too seriously, it would not work.
Right. And there are examples of games that have the opposite, that do have that overly stuffy tone. I feel like the tone I prefer, I mean, the only game I can really think of that does the super stuffy structure would be, like, AD&D First Edition. Which is written as
fantasy wargaming, the highest level of all.
Yeah, so these sort of stentorian games from early role-playing where they felt like they were writing more like textbooks than you know, games for people to play.
Well, and I think it's also the writing to their fellow nerds that they're like, ah, yes, we always have these forewords of like, you are a special certain kind of someone that plays a role-playing game.
Ah, yeah.
Ah. And so I think that tone goes along with the idea that the only people who are playing this are going to be, like, a certain kind of smart nerd.
Yeah, that's true. And then there's the overly aggressive tone that we've encountered from time to time, which doesn't make for an especially fun game. One that tries to just, you know, the ones that are like, if your players don't like it, fuck, they could deal with it. After all, life ain't fair. The amount of times, anytime I see that phrase in a game, I'm like, oh, I'm not going to like this book.
Nope.
Life ain't fair in particular is something where, yeah, but I'm not playing taxes. I mean, that's just it's just not fun. I'm playing a fun game. The game should be fun.
Yeah.
For example, I have something I actually prepared here for this. This is a section from one of the most hated games that we've ever covered, Star Trek's Prime Directive.
Yep, still one of my most hated games.
Yeah, and it's not even called Star Trek. So it's just called Prime Directive role-playing in the Starfleet universe or whatever it's actually called. There's a section in there where your character can argue to get XP in a mission that didn't go as well as the briefing officer, which is the GM of that game, thought that it should.
Yeah, you didn't quite accomplish your mission, but you did accomplish something.
You at least think that you can argue that you accomplished something. And so I'm just going to read this real quick here. And this whole section is titled Wheedling for Points. So right off the bat, wheedling. Your players are wheedling at this time.
Oh, yes. Well, Weedle is one of my favorite Pokemon, so.
All right. At the end of a mission, each member of a team can try to convince their briefing officer that they really did better overall on the mission than his initial assessment. There are special rules that apply to this negotiation task. First, before the GM lets the players make the reputation roll, he must rule that the scenario's assessment of the criterion of success did not adequately cover the positive value of the things that the team really did accomplish. That is to say, if the players didn't do exactly what the scenario called for, and they didn't do anything else particularly useful besides, then don't let them try to pull the wool over your eyes. Incidentally, that's caps. That's in all caps right there. If they really did screw up, fine. Don't feel bad about awarding a low or even negative rep award if they didn't do anything to deserve better. The GM has absolute final say on these awards, period. Life ain't always fair. If the GM rules that, okay, you got some good shots in, and the mission wasn't really as botched as it looks on paper, then you still have to try and sweet-talk your briefing officer into buying it too. This is a special application of professional reputation as described above. Each character, in turn, may try their hand at wheedling for points. Each character may only attempt this once per mission. After that, the reputation level dice are gone, remember? And characters may not combine their professional reputation levels into one big task test. Each character, in turn, may try the task, but each successive try adds the successive attempts mod to the try code from the previous attempt. If any attempt to wheedle for points results in a failure or a botch, then the briefing officer is no longer interested in entertaining further discussion on the topic, and the matter is closed. By the way, you cannot use heroic reputation to influence the wheedling task test. What would the audience say if they saw their favorite heroes begging for points? And scene. So, right off, let's talk about why that's a horrible, stupid thing.
Well, in so many ways. One, I mean, the very end there when it's like, well, what would the audience say? I'm like, dude, what would the audience say if there was a briefing officer, period?
I know. Just imagine the scenario that leads to that. Like you send down Sulu and Chekov to accomplish something, and they come back up. They're like, hey, there was a tar monster, and it ate Tasha Yar. Incidentally, this is a crossover universe, and we're all...
crossover event.
We're all hanging out together. And the briefing officer, which, by the way, who the fuck is that?
Yeah.
There's no briefing officer on the Enterprise. Or any Enterprise. So we'll just say it's Riker up there. And Riker, they get up to Riker, who's been demoted to briefing officer. And he's like, hey, you guys don't get any XP for doing this mission. Or, I don't know, gold press latinum or holodeck time or beard access. I don't, whatever. And Sulu's like, but Captain, I think we did some interesting things. And he doesn't roll his... But meanwhile, Chekhov's standing behind him like, ooh, I can't wait to argue my point as well, I guess. Sulu doesn't roll especially well, so Riker's like, you know what? Fuck the both of you. This matter is closed. I'm not interested in discussing payment anymore.
Yeah, and then, like, Chekhov goes, but wait, I had nope, nothing.
No interesting opinion coming from you, commie.
Get out.
What the fuck would that be in a Star Trek game? What happened to these people? At what point were they like, no, we're writing a game where people are aware that they're arguing for XP in Star Trek?
Yeah.
But they still have enough sense to put that sentence in at the end. It's like, what if your favorite Star Trek hero was caught doing this nonsense?
It would be fucking stupid. Yes, it would.
It would.
Why is this in this game?
What's it doing here? And then all this shit where it's like, if your players are trying to trick you, don't let them.
So
your players aren't going to... You're playing a game.
Yeah. If your players want some reward for all of the stuff that they just did, fuck them.
Make sure to give them a negative award instead.
Yeah.
That's the kind of tone...
Well, that entire book is just... the how to never get someone to play a game with you again.
Or a game at all. Like, woe betide the person whose first game is Prime Directive.
Oh, yeah. At that point, you're like, well, this is a hobby for idiots and terrible jerks. I am out. Goodbye.
I even have another one at the ready. I don't want to waste the time on it, but I have the one about sending people home to read 20 pages of a dictionary if their character almost dies.
No, it's the whole book is terrible.
So that's, Ryan, that's what we're talking about when we're saying that certain games have offensive or unfriendly tones. That's the mean end. And then there's the other end, which is pointless, like useless comet frippery. I'd say human-occupied landfill of our various reviews would be one that's like that, where it's so hard to extract a game from all the jokes.
Yeah, you're like, I think this is a game rule, but it might just be a stupid thing he wanted to say. I don't know.
Yeah, so there's most games are inside the balance of that, and trying to figure out where they've strayed on one end or the other is what game review is.
Yay.
All right, moving on.
Yep.
Is it me?
It's you. It's all you.
Am I asking the question? Okay, great. Number seven. So Feng Shui 2 is being read, as mentioned in the last podcast. It's mostly by me. I bought
and
it.
And this podcast.
Yeah, and this podcast.
And every goddamn day I talk to you.
It's so good. John hasn't read it yet. I bought it, and I'm going to give it to him when I'm done with it. And I'm sure, seeing as how he doesn't like reading role-playing games, he doesn't have to. No, I'm kidding. I know you do.
Considering he hates role-playing games.
Oh, yeah. He hates role-playing games, role-players, players, people.
Yeah, just in general.
Yeah. Rocks.
Birds. Things.
Sex. So Feng Shui 2 is being read, as mentioned in the last podcast. I really like that game and think it is rad, and you are right. Could you perhaps do a little discussion on how the removal of derived stats from the system and the resulting ease of play improves? I always find it fascinating that so many game systems have a base stat and related derived stat systems with oftentimes arcane and strange relations between them. But a lot of the more recentish games like Fate and Feng Shui 2 get rid of that and just let you directly get to the stats that actually matter for rolling, which does a lot of good to make balancing a lot easier, opens up more archetypes for designs within the rules, and solves the always take dexterity problem. And this question comes to us from Havoc 4. So we have reviewed Feng Shui, the first one. The official name of it, by the way, was Feng Shui, the first one.
Yeah.
So we've reviewed that, and yeah, it had a couple of the derived stat systems. I think there's two things you could potentially be talking about here. One of them is how, like D&D, for example, you have those numbers that range from 3 to 18 that do fuck all in modern D&D.
Yep.
Instead, they just have you look up a different chart that tells you between -4 and +4, and that's your actual stat. So that's one type of derived value stat. The other one is like what we just did in Blue Planet, where your character's like, what's my toughness? Oh, it's the average of my strength and willpower. Okay, well, what's my willpower? It's half your mental acuity plus your developmental disability.
Your developmental disability.
Plus 2 divided by 6.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just trying to come up with stats off the top of my head. Developmental disability came into my head. Because Blue Planet, I assume.
Yeah.
So,
The thing for me with the whole weird derived stats and things like that is I think the games have moved away from, for the most part with these types of games, from really trying to be simulationist. Because you saw that a lot with early games, especially Heartbreakers. But anytime someone was looking at a game, they're like, but that isn't how the way things work. I have to have more stats and more skills and cover more ground so it'll be more like the real world.
Mm-hmm.
And so the derived stats, they're like, oh, well, you know, the amount of, like, how tough you are, you wouldn't just have, like, constitution govern that because if my strength was super low but I had a high constitution, I still wouldn't be able to take a lot of punishment because strength would be... And so they just start spiraling up their own asshole.
Yeah, it starts right away with people who want to separate comeliness from charisma because they are a fat nerd who thinks they're good at talking, and they want to separate strength from constitution because they are a fat nerd who thinks that means they can take a lot of punishment.
Yeah, the idea
that... Just kidding,
that,
fat nerds. You guys are all fine, and I'm a fat nerd, too.
The idea that you need to have all of these, like, multiple stats and derived things and the points there... for when you're talking about the derived stats, as in, like, this is my fitness and it's from strength and constitution.
Yeah.
That just comes from I'm trying to get more and more realistic and deeper into a system.
Yeah.
Whereas the thing like the 3 to 18 actually being a -4 to +4 is mostly a sacred cow, but also really more of an idea that the larger numbers are more interesting to people, and it's the idea of, I could roll this still on 3d6 that grabs onto people, so that number range.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of why the minus 4 to plus 4 thing still sticks around in our heads, why we still think of 3d18 as a good stat block, is because of bell curves.
Well, yeah, you think of the 3d6 and you're like, this number means something because I can see it in a real-world application of dice.
Yeah.
The minus 4 to plus 4 doesn't have a real-world application. I can't roll, like, a D9 and have it give me a negative 4 to positive 4.
Well, you can. It's just that we won't get the interesting bell curve. The bell curve thing is what makes the 3 to 18 still relevant. Like, I mean, granted, I know that no one's rolling their stats in a modern D&D game anymore. It's all point by now. But back in, like, first edition, second edition, and so on, you were like, all right, the most likely stat I'm going to get is a 10 or an 11. And that's normal. That's a normal human as a 10 or 11. And it's all about those edge cases and outliers that make having an 18 strength so interesting.
Yeah.
It's an outlier. Wouldn't you know it, everyone cheats all the time when they're rolling up D&D characters, so it's not that rare to have a really high stat. But it was why that bell curve lived, and why it still does, is that people like the idea of random elements in a game, and it's the best way to get one in an interesting way. Because, you know, anytime you see one of those games, and we've seen a few of these, I think Cinnabar worked this way, where you get your stats by rolling a D20.
Yeah. Anytime you have way more swing to anything, like...
Or no curve.
Yeah, you're just like, man, this is either really punishing or way too good, and either way, you're going to end up breaking a game.
Yeah. So anyway, I think it's a good thing. I think the whole reducing stats down to the core elements of what you need, and Feng Shui 2, for example, uses... You have two attack stats. One of them's your primary, one of them's your secondary. They're usually things like guns and then martial arts. Then you have things like toughness and strength and so on that are very simple stats that make sense and are easy to use when you need them, and they don't inform any other stats. All the stats you're ever going to need are right on the side of your character sheet.
Yep.
Pretty simply put together. Yeah, I'm a fan too.
Okay, so here we go. Next question. I'm an amateur/hobbyist game designer, a future heartbreaker maker, and I've heard you guys use game design terms that seem like you didn't make them up, such as Vancey and Magic, which, of course, we wouldn't make that up.
No, we made that up. That was us. That's a System Mastery original.
Yeah, TM. Anytime you write Vancey, and you have to put a little R in a circle after it.
Yeah, I mean, we were... honestly, that's because John is short for Robert Vance.
Yeah.
And I think it's finally time we told everyone that John is Robert Vance, the author of such amazing books as...
Vance Saves Christmas.
Yeah.
And Vance Scared Stupid.
Robert Pierce Vancini's The Color of Her Panties.
Okay. Is there a solid community of game designers out there where common terms are used and invented? I've been going it alone for years. Finding your podcast was a complete revelation and has actually resulted in several improvements to the game I'm currently designing. Thank you for that.
Well, that's heartful.
It just seems like there's more out there hiding from me. And there is. Mostly it's internet.
I cut my teeth in this sort of shit on I hate to say this out loud, but Something Awful's traditional games discussion board had a really good setup of explaining game terms for me. The one thing I would avoid, and this is a personal preference thing, I'll put it out there. You could easily write up a glossary of good game design terms, but I think it's more important to avoid some of the big ones that are problematic, that aren't helpful, really. I'd say avoid GNS theory, because it's basically a way for angry nerds to say that their game is great and your game is terrible, even if they're the same game. It stands for Gaming Narrativist Simulationist, and if you can figure out what those mean in relation to each other, then you know more about it than anyone who talks about it on the internet.
The big thing for me is it, one, comes from reading and just playing way too many games to begin with.
Yeah, and so we've definitely done that.
And the other half is just the giant community of players that is online.
Yeah.
If you are around anything, so I mean, the Something Awful forums where we go to a lot, RPG.net, you go to...
Reddit's actually got a really good community for
this
sort of
thing. Yeah, the Reddit traditional games.
Yeah.
Don't ever go onto the 4chan games. No. Just don't.
Just don't go onto 4chan. What are you doing there?
Come on, man. What are you doing? But all of these communities, they have a lot of discussion that goes on, and especially if you drill down to specific games, you'll find a lot of the terms used more often for that.
Yeah.
So while if you're in a general discussion of games or game design, you'll see some terms bandied about. But if you were to go specifically into a game, then the terms that are used for that game are going to pop up way more often, and then you'll see how that relates to other games who use like mechanics that are similar to that.
Right. And you can find a lot of these forums that are really good sources of discussion. I would say this question came to us from Reddit, so you're in a good place already. It's a good start. That's a good place to read about this sort of thing. The only thing I would say to avoid is GNS theory people, and then any place where they seem to be venerating some sort of online gaming luminary. I mean, if you find a site that's like, well, according to Zach S. and Frank Trollman, you need to get out of there.
Honestly, if you find a place that's like, well, according to John and Jeff of System Mastery.
I've seen that, and it freaks me out.
Oh, yeah. No, there's been threads I've seen somewhere where they're like, well, these two guys said this, and I believe their opinion. I'm like, oh, don't believe us. We're idiots.
I'm not exactly sure when we made the transition from dorks who were making fun of each other to, like, game experts.
Yeah, we are professional gamesmen.
It's hilarious to me. But, yeah, there are a few people out there that spend a lot of time just venerating, like, you know, luminaries of game design. Not even game design, but game play structures. Usually it happens a lot with the people who are part of the OSR, which, again, if you're not used to gaming terms, that stands for old school role playing, and it's people who insist on the perfection and purity of games from like the late 70s, except they're all playing new games that are designed to simulate games from the late 70s, which really means they're playing new games and pretending that they have an interesting agenda that they're playing older games.
Yeah. So. Well, there's a lot of the ideas of earning your fun things like that will get transferred over. I like to call it the EverQuest system, where a lot of people who played EverQuest, just the first huge MMO, will look back on it and go like, man, back in my day, we had amazing fun. I had to sit on a boat for half an hour in order to get to a different place. I had 12 different loading screens, and then when I got there, I immediately died. That's how you play an MMO. And everyone nowadays goes, no, that sounds like garbage. Why would you do that? And they're like, oh, I'm just saying that I did it, so everyone else should have to suffer like I did.
Yeah, and you still see people like that with their whole bring WoW back to its vanilla server state, for example.
Yeah, the
Can
people
you just
who...
give us the vanilla server? And the answer is, you don't want a vanilla server. It's awful.
No, I mean, there are people who are like, oh, I still play the original EverQuest, or I played on that vanilla WoW server or whatever. And you have those people, and if that's what they want, this really, like, intensely horrible experience where you have to grind out anything that you want.
Yeah.
Sure, fine. You can have that, but that's not something that is widely appealing.
That's the thing, is that they always seem to want it for everybody.
Yeah, they're always like, well, this is how I like it, so everyone should like it that way.
Yeah, when realistically, you shouldn't be barring other people's progress because you had a fun game 40 years ago.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the same thing of, if I really like, let's say, ultra sour food, and I'm like, I love things that are sour, everyone should eat everything sour. No, that's not a thing. Don't do that.
Well, it's true, though. Everyone should eat constantly very sour things.
Yes.
I'm eating 3 atomic warheads right now.
Man,
oh, is that the hot one? What's the super sour?
Oh, they had both.
Okay,
the warheads had both sour and hot. Man, right. I had a toxic waste sour candy the other day, and it was only sour for like 5 seconds, and I was like, man, this is disappointing.
I had my childhood, it was actually terrible flashback a couple of weeks ago when I found myself a bottle of it's that blue soda. It's like Love Potion 60, Brainwash.
Okay.
Brainwash is the soda that I had when I was a teenager, and I convinced myself it was good, even though it's like black pepper flavored.
Ugh.
It tastes like jalapenos and soap. It is unpleasant, but I thought it was super cool because it had a skull on the bottle, and the label had a spot that said, send us 20 bottle caps, and we'll send you something fucking cool. And I was like, this is awesome. I love this gross soda.
I love buying soda from Hot Topic.
Yeah. Now, I found one at a BevMo or something and tried it, and I was like, ah, this is garbage. Why was I doing this to myself? Anyway, kids these days should be drinking this gross soda.
Yeah. Oh, and that came to us from Jag Gnomon.
Thank you. All right, next question. D&D has a long, proud tradition of stupid golems made of stupid things.
True.
One of the silliest is the brain golem, made by the Mind Flayers, who eat brains. So, question. The Mind Flayers have constructed a giant super brain golem to destroy the world. You must construct a giant golem out of some foodstuffs to stop it. What foodstuffs do you choose, why, and what powers does it possess? All right, I am going to say that I'm going to have it be a transformer that turns into the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile.
That's not food.
No, it's except this one is actually made of Oscar Mayer wiener.
Oh, okay. It's That's
a giant,
fine then.
It's a giant hot dog that turns into a hot dog bot. And this is literally just because I like the idea of a transformer that turns into the Oscar Mayer wiener. It's not because I'm trying to brand aware or brand connect us to hot dogs. I didn't realize that until I was halfway through. And I was
yeah,
like,
I was
fuck,
like, God, you are so on brand.
Hot dog will. No. All right, so it should be made out of some sort of dude of cheese.
I'm going to make a giant dude made of cheese. Then we're going to have a big old hot dog, and it will baffle him with questions. In jokes. Okay, no, I'm going to go with... Well, hold on. I'm going to ask you a question and see if this works.
Sure, fire.
Okay, does gum count as a foodstuff? Can I make a gum golem?
Can you eat gum?
Yeah, I mean, technically, yes.
Yeah, you can. Because all those shit about how it gets stuck in your stomach forever is a myth. You can eat all the gum you want. It's just that it's not very nutritious.
Yeah, it has nothing else to do. You're just going to shit out a lump of
gum. You're not going to notice it. It'll be poop colored. But it's not very digestible. So it's... So yeah, sure. You can make a gum golem. I don't think anyone's going to stop you.
Great. Gum golem. Done. And it's going to be great at grappling. You're never going to be able to get away from it. It'll stick to you.
Yeah.
And it's got a morphable body, so it can take punishment.
That is true. It could take a whole lot of punishment. It'd basically be like a clay face.
Yeah. I mean, you'd pretty much only be defeating it through, like, you know, fire or stuff like that, because any, like, kinetic attack isn't really going to matter.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. That's... Gum golem.
All right, I'm going to make my golem out of nothing but offensive French foods, just so that way no one wants to touch it or get near it, and it has a automatic sort of, like, intimidate attack because of how offensive it is. So it's a golem made out of, like, veal and goose liver pate and ortolan. If you don't know what ortolan is, it's a tiny bird that you drown in cognac, and then you have to eat it you have to eat it, bones and all, in a boiling hot, it's supposed to be super way too hot for you. And you have to eat it with a towel draped over your head and the bowl so that God doesn't see what you're doing.
Man, that really sounds made up.
I know, but it's not. French people are gross.
Yeah.
And so that's going to be my golem. It's just going to be every type of offensive, you shouldn't be eating that food. Now, if you ask a vegan, it's just going to be a golem made of meat. But to me, it's going to be it has to be a little more extreme.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there you go. Mine's going to be a gross offensive foods golem.
Thank you, the Mad Wobbler.
There you go.
I've noticed in a lot of your reviews, you seem to be unclear of just what an adventure session of a game system should look like, e.g. Bunnies and Burrows, Testament, and lately Blue Planet. Do you think more systems should include some sort of sample adventure or similar to better establish what playing the system should look like? For example, D&D's starter sets are usually capable of establishing what they expect the gameplay of the edition they were written for to look like, while Apocalypse World has numerous examples of play to establish what using it should look like. This comes from Flame Titan. Well, not so much sample adventures, although those are always sort of fun to see in the back, but more like the examples of play are fine, but really just give me an example of something someone could do in the game.
I would like to see a sample adventure, because I feel like, just using these examples, I feel like Testament had a list of things you could do in the game, and it was useless. It was like, maybe your village is affected by local plagues.
You're like, okay, and then what do I do?
Maybe mice get into your grain harvest.
Yeah, okay, having a sample adventure at least tells you what the writers think you should be doing.
I feel like if the writers are going to put forward a game that on basic examination seems like it is impossible to play, or the onus of proof is on them to show that you can write a story in it.
Yeah, if they can come up with something that's like, here's the game that we did, here's what you should be doing in here, because something like...
Numenon is a...
yeah.
Prove it. Prove you can fucking run Numenon, game designers.
Yeah, it's the sort of thing where you look at it and you go, okay, something like Testament or Blue Planet, it might say, here's some things that go on in this world, but that's not an adventure idea. Like... Blue Planet can tell me, maybe you'll be mining, or maybe you'll have to deal with some corporation. Or Testament can tell me, maybe the neighboring Canaanites will want to fight you and get into a war. But that doesn't tell me what, personally, my character should be looking forward to.
Right.
Because, again, a war happening is like, yeah, but if I'm just a level one character in a D&D-esque game, that means nothing to me. And if I'm just some miner on Blue Planet, then, again, I'm not playing this game to be in a mining simulation. What is the point of me doing this?
Yeah, I feel like of the games that were listed in the example from the letter, the one that is the most obvious what you're supposed to do in it is Bunnies and Burrows, because it tells you how often you have to roll random encounter tables, and it's like every 10 minutes.
Oh, yeah, what does this game look like? Random encounter tables and maybe go steal someone's wife.
Yeah. You're playing Sim Bunny is what that game is.
Yeah.
Your bunny, you start every adventure with your bunny goes outside. All right, you encounter a worm.
Yeah, the weird thing to me was when they finally threw in at the end, they're like, maybe you go to a magic cave. And you're like, whoa, hold on.
A magic cave? This is a game where you play real rabbits that have psychic powers and disguise themselves as bats, and sometimes they go in a magic cave, but they're real rabbits.
Yeah, what? Here we go.
They can speak scorpion.
Okay,
all right.
Sure.
Blue Planet actually did have a lot of story descriptions in it. There were all these little sidebar stories, like the one that still sticks out to me is the killer. The one that's like, it's some professional assassin who goes into a hotel restaurant to kill a guy and is just endlessly yammering on and on about what it's like to be a super killer. And it has that, there's 30 of them and only one of me, looks like the odds are in my favor line in it. There's a time and a place to unload that line. That line is as old as the hills, but it can be unloaded correctly still in certain situations.
Yeah.
Wasn't in that one.
Not
but
there.
And in that one, the characters say, oh, and I can't wait to get my hands on that guy's delicious-looking steak after I kill him. I'll have to come back to this restaurant because that steak looks good. And the whole time I'm thinking, so is the rest of the party standing outside while you go on your jag-off, like, self-flagellation mission here, where you just stare in a mirror, jerk off, and say, I'm an assassin?
It's also the same thing anytime they were talking about the marshal, is it's just, oh, all these examples of play are one guy shooting people and being a badass and nothing else.
Well, you know, no one ever hits him and he never misses.
Great. Yeah, there were no ideas of what a party does. It was just, I don't know, here's a planet and you fucking figure it out.
Here's a short story I wrote about a cool guy.
Wonderful.
Great, yeah, all right. So, I like I said, I feel like, yes, I love sample adventures because especially, you know, if the game's understandable and easy, then I might breeze past the sample adventure and just see if there's anything shocking in it. Like, you know, after the bomb one that we read.
That is exactly what I was thinking
of.
Yeah,
that one had a sample adventure that was, like, insane.
Yeah, because you had sort of a weird setup, but you're like, okay, I kind of get what you're going for here. And then the sample adventure, you're like, what the fuck is going on here?
Yeah, there's super robots and sort of rapey bunnies. What is happening?
Yeah.
You know, something like Blue Planet, I would have loved to see a sample adventure in the back just to give me an idea of what the game designers thought the game was going to look like. That's what I want to know.
Yeah.
I want to see an example of one of their playtests. That'd be the best thing. Not even a sample adventure, but literally an example of one of their playtests. Like, show me how this game went for you.
Huh.
So there you go. All right, next question comes to us here from Mirdradek. Oh, that must be a magic reference of some kind. All right, here we go. Two questions. Number one, imagine four hot dogs on the edge of a cliff. Say a direct copy of the hot dog nearest the cliff is sent to the back of the line of hot dogs and takes the place of the first hot dog. The formerly first hot dog becomes the second becomes the third, and the fourth falls off the cliff. Time works the same way. Given all this, do you eat the first hot dog and cause a time paradox?
Yes.
Johnny Five Aces.
Done.
Yes, I guess we did.
Yes, done.
Second question. You've brought up, this is you, John, have brought up Rift's World Book 4, Africa, on the show several times. And John sounds like he has an entertaining rant in him about the subject. So, John, what's the deal with Rift's World Book 4, Africa?
Oh, my God. World Book 4 is the craziest shit to me because this comes right after England. And England was kind of like, oh, there's fairies and a world tree and elves and the kind of shit you'd expect to be in England, and then randomly some, like, temporal raider stuff.
Yeah, there's a lizard that can control one of the giants from the conversion book real good.
Great. So you got there, and then you went to Africa, and you're like, all right, cool, what's in Africa? And they're like, literally the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And you're like, oh, so is this, like, four robots that someone made to represent? No. The actual four horsemen of the apocalypse. War and death and pestilence and famine are running around in Africa being all weird and super powerful.
And by running around, we mean that they are at like four edges of Africa, sort of, and they are all heading towards each other in the middle.
Yeah.
And when they meet, they're going to turn into a super tornado of ultra doom.
Oh my God, it's amazing. I look at it and I'm like, what is the point of this?
Also, why Africa? If you get to the middle of Africa and turn into a whirlwind tornado of Ultra Doom, who's going to care? You're in the Sahara. God, I'm going to destroy all this sand.
And then the rest of the book fluctuates wildly between being fairly offensive and just weird.
Yeah, there's a few somewhat offensive things. Not too bad.
No. The thing is, it was nowhere near as bad as it could have been. Not like, say, Mystic China.
Rift Japan.
Yeah, all of that shit where they were like, let's just get all of the stereotypes in there.
And just turn them into robots and be done with it.
Yeah.
What do Japanese people like? Samurai? They're cyber samurai. You like them weird no-wingy dragons? They got robot ones. Go, have fun. Have fun in Japan.
Do it. What is this? Sumo power armor? Good job.
Good. Everything's set.
Yeah, so at least with Rifts Africa, it was one of the books where I was like, this seems to my like 12-year-old brain to be amazingly cool, and yet how do you run a game in that?
Oh,
what is the meta plot of trying to stop a literal god? It's the same thing with Pantheons of the Megaverse book, where you look at it and you're like, what is this? Oh, it's a bunch of dudes with 30,000 MDC.
And what it really does is it reveals the big secret that not that many people know about Palladium and Rift's game design in general, which is that a lot of the really big monsters from the early games that have way too much MDC are Kevin Symbieta's own creations that he created for his own games, and Kevin Symbieta games had like 12 goddamn players.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Anytime you see one of those monsters, it's like, I have 30,000 MDC. It would take forever for a regular party to cut through me, so you're not going to bother. Then you realize that you're playing with a party that's four times the size of a regular party.
Yeah, and they've all got ridiculous weaponry.
Yeah, so all those monsters were designed to appease his parties, which are stupid. No one plays that way. Only Symbieta plays like that.
And I will say this, I did end up playing a game where we went to Africa and I had my Titan Juicer get into a wrestling match with War. So there you go. That's why I love Rifts.
I want to say the better part of a year and a half trying to convince my DM that if I could kill one of the horsemen that I should be allowed to steal its giant dog. Because let's be clear, those war beast things they were riding on didn't look like horses. Even if you squinted and tried to find the magic eye horse in them, they looked like giant dogs.
Yeah, well.
The only one that looked...
Death had one that looked like a horse.
Had a horsey-looking one, and Famine's was so emaciated that it could have looked like either. But War's was a dog.
Oh, yeah, he was straight up on a big war dog, and I loved it.
Yeah, I wanted that dog. And I said, if I could kill War, can I have that dog? No. Well, okay, but I should be able to have that dog, because I'm the new War, right? No.
No, you're not the new War. You just killed War. There's no more War anymore.
Well, then no one's going to stop me from trying to take this dog. What are they going to do? Declare fight with me?
Yeah. I declare combat, not a war. Combat.
That's me. I'm the new combat. One of the four horsemen of the apocalypse.
Grievous bodily injury.
I'm just one of the four horses of the apocalypse.
There you go. So yeah, no. Rifts Africa. Amazing.
Yep.
Mind bleeders,
which by the way, the art for the mind bleeder, fantastic.
Everything's great. I love everything.
Gross pulsy head. I remember being super disappointed when I got my copy because it didn't have one of the races it had in it. It was like, hey, there's these little tree people. They're like crazy little flap-winged arm dude koala bears. They're really neat. They live in the trees. Anyway, next page. Here's a different race. Whoops, we forgot the stats.
Editing. Not happening in one of these games.
That book also had a rare occurrence of one of my favorite things in Rifts, which was Kitani power armor suits.
Yeah, those were always weird to see.
They were really cool. There were two in Rifts Atlantis, which was so good. The snaky one and the horsey one.
I was going to say the centaur and the serpent.
Yep. Yeah. And then there's also the worst one is in South America where it has the raptor, which just looks like a robot velociraptor.
Yeah.
They fucked up. It doesn't have the cool alien-y lines of the other ones.
No, you just look like a robot raptor.
Yeah, that one was terrible. But the one in Rifts Africa is solid. It's the crab. And it's it's like a floating hover crab that actually has pinchers and stuff.
Yeah.
It was really neat.
Vibro pincers.
Yeah, it was cool. So there you go. Another Kitani power armor suit in there. One of my favorite things to see.
Yeah. So I think the reason I love World Book 4 is because it's the most Rifts to me in that it just throws everything it possibly can in there.
It's very scattershot. The other one that does the same thing to really good effect is Atlantis.
Yeah.
Where you
the meta plot is just insanity and you'll never do it.
And you've forgotten all the shit that's in Atlantis by now. There's fucking a half man, half duck in it called a Hark Duck. You just remembered that, didn't you, listener? All right, John, go ahead.
Okay. Last question, here we go. If you were in a band together, what kind of music would you make, and what would the band be called?
Oh,
well, we'd make terrible music, because we're terrible at that.
Because John can sing, and I can't do anything else, and I didn't do any kind of music classes when I was a kid, so...
Nope. If you give me a recorder, I can make annoying noises.
Yeah, and if you put me in front of a piano, I can play the basic one-note-at-a-time version of the Empire Strikes Back march, which is the only thing I can play on a piano.
Good.
But we have made a band together.
Yeah, we have. And they're in Rock Band.
Yeah, we have our Rock Band band that I guess we could describe to you as that counts.
Yeah, they are the Magical Sex Blokes.
The Magical Sex Blokes has been our band for forever. Lead singer, Harry Sexy.
Harry Sexy Truman.
Harry Sexy Truman. He is a he's a sexy, sybaritic, pink-haired weirdo who is the richest man in the world, and he lives in a two-bedroom flat in the Vatican City.
Yep. And you've got my guy, the lead guitarist, Randy Nigel Randy.
Yeah, Randy Nigel Randy, who's a skinny, trash-digging punk.
And the quotes on Randy changes whenever he feels like it.
Sometimes there's a comma.
Yeah, sometimes he's Randy Nigel Randy, and sometimes he's Randy Nigel Randy.
Yeah, and then there is our bassist, Swinging Sidney Brass.
Yep, he is the Earl of fucking Dorchester.
Yeah, Earl of fucking Dorchester.
And a notary public.
Thank you, a registered notary public. He is a Pakistani immigrant to the UK.
Yep.
And then finally, there's our bassist. I don't even want to say what he is. let's just say he's a publicly registered asshole, Andy Sherry.
Yeah, Andy Sherry, who needs to go door-to-door whenever he moves into a new neighborhood.
To tell people that he is an asshole and see if their parents are around.
There you go. That's our band.
That's our band. They exist already. We have made that band. What kind of music do they make? Music petering out around 2005 when people stopped making music for Rock Band 3.
There you go.
If you were in rival bands, what would their names and genres be, and who would have started the rivalry? I'm sorry, I'm stealing your question. Go ahead, though.
Let's see. I'll go ahead and be in my rad industrial band called Plastic Epiphany.
Okay.
And Plastic Epiphany takes itself super serious and is very... hardcore industrial.
All right, and I'm going to be in my 70s surf rock band, which is called $7,000.
Yep. how dare you take my bassist?
Your bassist is named $7,000.
No, his bassist is Defunct Money.
Yeah, Defunct Money. I was going to say no, $7,000. The lead singer is Dusty Space Lasers. That's where that originally came from.
Yeah, and then D period Funked. F-U-N-K-E-D, Money,
yeah,
is the bassist.
Money.
Defunct
yeah.
Money.
He's the bassist in both bands.
Yeah. That's why there's a rivalry.
There's a rivalry between Plastic Epiphany and $7,000.
There you go. And that's why it started, because they both have the same bassist.
So then, and it's industrial and dancey surf rock from the 70s, respectively.
Yeah.
All right. There we go. That's everything.
There we go. That's all of our questions for the week. Thank you so much for sending those in.
Yeah, thanks for the questions. Now we need more, so keep them coming in. You guys are doing
an
amazing job.
Oh, that was from Sigrisg.
Yeah,
Sigrisg.
Sigrisg.
Sagrasg. That was S-G-R-S-G, Sigrisgers.
Sargesg.
Sargesg.
Yeah, those G's stand for graphics.
Oh, yeah, sorry, it's Sigrisg.
It's Sigraphical Risgraphics.
Fucking graphical ifs.
Hey, that keeps me out of the fight. If you didn't know this already, people, I call the graphical image format, I call those graphical ifs.
Yeah, because he doesn't want to take a side. He's a fence sitter on the war.
I'm a fence sitter.
He's not going to be on the right side of history, which is GIF.
Yeah, graphic if. It's got if right in the title. I don't know. I'm leaving it open for everybody. It's a graphic if. I don't like fighting.
It's a GIF, and anyone who says otherwise is a heathen. I know that the people who created it say it's the other way, but death of the author.
I'm not the horseman of pronunciation. I wouldn't be allowed to take his cool horse even if I was.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to stick with graphic if, and it's fine.
There you go.
So there you go, folks. Thanks so much for listening to another episode of Afterthought. As always, we need your questions. Send them to us at systemmastery@gmail.com, systemmastery on Facebook or Twitter. If you send them through those ways, make sure you put something in there so that I can search them later, especially on Twitter. I lose questions on Twitter immediately.
Yeah, it's true. Also, if you want, it's my birthday. Send me money.
Send John money. Our address is 123 Anytown, USA, Fake Street. I actually am working on getting us a P.O. box so people can mail us shit without having to give away our real address.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
So that's coming up. We'll get that done in the next month or two.
Next Patreon goal, $410.
No, we can't keep spending it all. But no, all right. So next Patreon goal is, well, at the moment, it's the $3,000 we buy a micro pig thing, because you guys have been amazing and gotten us to the 400 where we go ad-free and get the storage we need. If you like what you hear from us, go ahead and support us on Patreon, patreon.com/systemmastery. If you give us any amount of money, you get our bonus content episodes. And this is the new thing. This is super awesome. If you support us on Patreon, you get our private RSS feed on there. And that one RSS feed contains all of our System Mastery, Afterthought, Movie Mastery, and bonus content episodes on one RSS feed.
It's simple. You no longer have to share an RSS feed with the rest of these plebeians who don't enjoy our bonus content.
Yeah.
Oh, no. You're at the gold level.
Well, I mean, we've had this years now. We've been having people who are complaining that the Patreon system, while it's nice to give us the money, isn't all that nice when it comes to downloading the bonus episodes.
Now, normally we had that RSS feed available, but it was only to our platinum level subscribers who are giving us at least $100 or more.
Yes, or dick. If they get, yeah.
At least 100 dicks or more.
Yes. At that level, you get our special platinum reserve. You can buy all kinds of amazing things.
Yeah, no, it's great. You get content that no one knows about. We're not even allowed to say it on air.
We don't even know about it, but you get it somehow.
We go into a fugue, a creative fugue, and then you get content.
And you can run your at the platinum level, you get to run your fingers lightly through John's beard.
Very lightly, though.
Very lightly. It's important. That's when it's best, anyway. You go into a freezing ice hotel. John is there. You run your fingers through his beard. A single note is played on a mandolin, and then you exit.
You are ushered away, and you have gained a new experience and enlightenment.
John is also going to leave the ice hotel because he hates it there.
Nah, man, that is the perfect hotel.
So anyway, support us on Patreon if you like. We don't have a current goal beyond at $3,000 an episode where we buy a micro pig. That is a joke that has lasted 2.5 years, and I'll be damned if I'm not going to buy a micro pig someday. Otherwise, support us that way. Find us on Reddit, Facebook, Gmail, Twitter, whatever you want to do. Just thanks so much for listening. Keep supporting. Keep being our friends and listening to us. And you have a good week.